O God, give me this minute of eternity to trust and live in Thee. May I be still in Your light and let life revolve around me. Let life evolve in my soul. I feel Christ full and in charge. I cease moving, thinking, feeling for others and give them over and over to Your holy care. I place these thoughts deep in the stillness, in the quiet deep beyond the range of my present understanding, and wait in the mystery until Your thought overflows. No word, no pressure, simply life oneness, God oneness, communion. Amen. I thought I'd try standing still today. We'll see how long that lasts. I'm having a wonderful prayer group, and we draw angel cards at the end. Yesterday it was humor, and the one today made me giggle, and it was enthusiasm. And all I have to do is watch the Jack-Dana combination up here, and it's with the angel of enthusiasm is in spades. I also thought it might have something to do with a heavy dinner we all ate, and my needing to keep it lively to keep you awake. So I told you most of my prayer is silent prayer, and I'm very grateful for and very impressed with people who can pray words that move my spirit and my soul and open my heart. But silence does that for me. So I tend to have short little prayers. And because I usually need things in a hurry, I've usually gotten myself in some kind of a jam and I need help to get them out. So here, I did them, my top prayers. So my first one is, I love you, Jesus. That's my fastest way to connect. And the next one right that comes on the heels of that is thank you. Then what usually follows that is what? And then help. And sometimes there's a really. At the end, there's always a use me. And then a mantra that I've loved, and it's not original, but I have nowhere idea where I got it, is love the folks in front of you. That if that were our only work to do, wherever we are, we would change the world very quickly. And I love that about CFO, that in fact is what we do. things were a bit muddy yesterday for me. First of all, it was humid and muddy. Let's see. Know if I can get this right, but there's a, I think it's Lao Tzu who said, can you be still long enough to let the mud settle so the right action arises by itself? And I think that for me, yesterday was about really not fully immersing myself in your community, although I felt like I did that with the people here. I was overwhelmed by the depth and the power that I felt of your commitment to the vision of CFO, the original vision of CFO. And I'm still very touched by that, and touched by a lot of you. My first camp at Asilomar, I was doing some work with Hope Peel, for those of you that know her now, Hope Farr, in her Harmonicos organization. We were doing some work together. And she said, oh, I'm speaking at this camp. You know, why don't you just come down to my Pacific Grove for a few days and you can stay in my room and we'll hang out. And I said, oh, that sounds like fun. I'd never been to an all-adult camp. My daughter had grown up in a family camp and that's what I was used to. And I arrived, and I was decidedly younger by about 30 years than anybody else in the room. Now, that was a while ago. And it was kind of like, oh my, this is different. The good news is I didn't have a red string or a blue fish. But I'm an observer. And so I observed what was going on, and I noticed a lot of what I noticed at this camp, and there are these quiet little spaces where people just kind of hang out. And what I visualize and what I see are these pillars of prayer. I see it in the trees here. I was just pretty overwhelmed last night, and I was also overwhelmed with the humidity. So I'm trying to let the mud settle and let the right action rise by itself. I love synchronicities. It's one of God's way of telling me that I'm moving my foot, one foot in front of the other, on the right path. And one of the first of all, after I got done with the surprise that I'd be coming here, I was guided to pick up a very old book, Windows of Heaven, which many of you are familiar with. And I was guided to pick one day for the 6 days I'd be speaking. And I thought, oh, okay, that's great. I love this book, but I hadn't touched it in a while. So I'd walked myself through it day by day early on in my CFO experience. And I thought, okay, I have some favorites in here, but I don't know where they are. So God, help me find a way to, without having to read this whole book again, help me find out what you want me to do. So I picked out actually my favorite, and I understand there's another person in camp that has a favorite, because as I was going through this lovely, I don't know what you call it, handbook, I think you called it. Dinty also likes this, because this is my favorite, We Find Each Other. And if you haven't seen it, I also noticed that Clyde was on this page too. So I understand I'll find out more about that tomorrow, but it's really, really beautiful daily meditation from Glenn Clark. So I'm going to let you read that on your own, since I forgot this last night. But what happened after that, after I let this sit on my coffee table for a couple days, is that I opened it, and I often open books at the back. And at the very back, kind of where the book fell open, were 5 notations of photographs and where they were taken. And in this book, there are 5 of them from Winnie. So there are some very old pictures. I don't know, some of you might recognize some folks in here. I don't, but thought it was really quite wonderful. And the first one I'm going to do is, I didn't write the page down, though. Let's see, is it 46? Did I get lucky? I just like to read this as kind of a context for the talk. So it's called The Forgiveness of Christ. And there's a wonderful picture of actually folks not on benches but on half-sawed logs. And I don't know if this is down by the rock pulpit or not. Is that? Oh, it is. Okay, fabulous. Well, some very prayer-filled people, I should say. And it says, the only way to receive perfect cleansing from sin and sickness is through repentance. The publican in the temple who said, God, be merciful to me, a sinner, received the blessing of Christ's promise, redemption. Whenever a prodigal returns, saying, I have sinned against heaven in thy sight, we know he is coming home to the love of an all-forgiving Heavenly Father. One of the most difficult blessings to accept, however, is this cleansing through the forgiveness of Christ. Many persons who suffer physical sickness remain uncured simply because they cannot believe in the healing power of repentance. And so we must try to recognize this purging, drawing power of God's love, so that we can yield ourselves trustingly to Him for complete cleansing. Suppose we think of it this way. God has a celestial vacuum cleaners in which his angels can use up to draw out all poisons, toxins, and infections in our souls and bodies. So let's invite the Lord to send down a corps of angel cleaners and put them to work right now. As they are invisible, they can penetrate into any pocket or hidden area of our lives and turn on their celestial vacuums. Since these angels neither slumber nor sleep, let them keep on the job day and night for a week if necessary, or a month, and let them go clear through the corridors of time, even into our babyhood, and open hidden closets which may conceal that terrible fright in infancy, whose frustrations of youth and resentments of middle age. Pray to the Father that they will not work too fast, as you do not want them to cause any pain. And tell him that you are waiting for his healing love to flow in. Until the heavenly transfusions of the blood of Christ heal all sores and fill all empty places. Thank him now in Jesus' name and rise up, a new creation. Forgiveness has been very, very powerful in my life. I left you with most of the Bell's palsy story last night. I mentioned a woman named Edith Stauffer and her work. I just wanted to tell you a little bit about Edith. She's in her 90s now. She's in her mid-90s. She's not traveling as much internationally. When I first met her, she was in her mid-70s. And I didn't meet her through CFO. And I had no idea of her connection with Glenn Clark or anything. I was speaking at a teaching conference at a county in Sacramento County. And they had the in-service days for teachers, and they had all of these different tracks that you could go take a look at, and they had six tracks, and each talk was an hour long, and then they gave each of us, the people who were doing the instructing, an hour free. So I looked at what my options were on this teaching track of all kinds of things, and I found this one little thing that said unconditional love and forgiveness, and I thought, well, now this is interesting. And so I walked in to this room, just trying to figure it out, and there were like three people in the room. And you know how you turn around and you think, well, this isn't going to be right. I just want to leave. But because I understand what it's like to have 400 people in one room and three in another, I decided I would stay. And then I watched this little lady with white hair, bright, shining face. I watched her take out her overhead, you know, the old overhead projector. She had overheads. And I watched her take them out of crocheted pillowcases, specially hand sewn. And I thought, oh my goodness. This is before iPads or any of the latest technology, but it still was a bit of a shock. And I thought, okay, well, I can do anything for an hour. And there were a few more people that showed up, and there were probably 10 people in the room. She asked for a volunteer to go through her forgiveness process. And I watched a Jewish soldier from World War II, he was British, and actually the Jewish faith. He'd lost his entire family in the Holocaust. I watched him forgive the Nazis in that room. And for me, that experience was, I was one of those where I had to kind of close my mouth because it seemed so simple and yet so powerful. And there was a healing for every single one of us. I wasn't even born during World War II. But I felt a release like I've never felt before, and I'd done forgiveness work. And that's why I loved Glenn's idea about the angels with vacuum cleaners. It might actually be that easy if we're willing to forgive. And I think about how long we carry our stories and our wounds and how often we lead with those wounds as a way of connecting with other people. And are we really ready to lead those wounds and fill that 100% with love, so that that's what we have to share? We're all wounded. I don't care if you've had the best childhood, the best parents, the best grandparents, the best living situation, whatever. We all learn what we need to, some of us in different ways, and we all have to deal with that. It's one of the things I've always, not always, I aspire to think about when I'm dealing with somebody particularly that's upsetting me, is that they have a history that I cannot possibly know. They have wounds that I may not know about. And the longer I live and the more I listen to people and really want to listen to what's on their hearts, the more I realize that it's not for me to judge any of that. It's for my job is to love the people in front of me. So Edith was a wife, a mother of three, on a farm in Texas. And I would imagine it was a hard life. And she was ironing one day in the kitchen after her three children were grown. She was 50 years old. And she heard this person on the radio. And he was called a psychologist. And she thought that was pretty interesting. And her husband, Paul, came home that night, and she said, "Honey, I'm going back to school, and I'm going to be a psychologist." So at 50, she went to, got her bachelor's degree. She got her 60-ish, she got her master's degree. About 65, she got her PhD. And studied with Roberto Assazioli and did a lot of transpersonal psychology. Was one of his first students. And then created an organization that she called Psychosynthesis International. That's not the part of the story that I'm most interested in sharing with you. She wrote her first book when she was 70. By the time she was 76, it was published in 8 languages. And she traveled all over the world teaching people this very simple unconditional love and forgiveness process. So it's a bit complex to share with you here. It is in her book. And I'm just amazed at who she was. She had, I would say, circles of people wanting to work with her. So I would arrive at her office, and there would be a PhD filing papers. There would be people just interested. And she tended to involve people. She's one of those folks who figured out what your passion was and helped you fulfill it. So in her book, she did a lot of work with the translation of certain words that Jesus spoke from Aramaic, the original language, to English. And one of the things that struck me most in terms of her process is she talked about something called a nafsha, which is our soul. And then she talked about I don't remember what the Aramaic word for sin was. But what that meant is, actually it was an archery term. And someone would be down by the target, some brave soul, probably a servant is my guess, and would be down by the target, and they would be doing target practice with arrows, and there was obviously a bullseye usually, and the servant would yell back to give feedback to the person that was doing this long distance bow and arrow. And they would yell sin because they had missed the bullseye, but they were still on the target. And they would yell evil if they had completely missed the target. So I was fascinated with that. I'm sorry I probably could have looked up those words, but it always made me think about kind of the upbringing I had about sin and evil and how different Jesus may have meant it. I have no idea if that's the truth or not, but it did strike me as very interesting, and also struck me as a way for me to ask for forgiveness when I'm missing the mark, when I've missed the whole target. So back to the Bell's palsy. Like I said, I had this paralyzed face, and I was driving over to actually Bodega Bay. We built a vacation home on the ocean in Bodega Bay, and I was listening to the song I played for you, which actually several of you knew, which I was excited about. And I listened to it for 3 hours straight. It was a 3-hour drive from my house in the mountains to the house at the ocean. And by the time I arrived, the paralysis was gone. And although it was a little difficult to sing and I had trouble forming my words, it was an incredible lesson. And I had a feeling that there was some great learning for me, but I was so relieved that it was gone that I just kind of skipped the learning. So I spent the week at the ocean by myself, and kind of in a little personal retreat, doing what I needed to do. Remember, I'd just been on this long leg of things to do. And got back home, wrote thank you letters to everybody who'd been praying for me, put the period at the end of the sentence, got up, and it was Christmas Eve. And the paralysis had moved from one side of my face to the other. And I wasn't done. So I actually got home, and I knew that I had a handle on this, but I wasn't quite sure where. And I called Edith, and that's when she said, oh, I think this isn't physical. Why don't you come over? We'll do a little forgiveness. And I tapped into some rage that felt like it was centuries old. I mean, I'm a nice person. I don't get too upset with people. I do blow on my lid occasionally, and if so, watch out. Everybody just kind of clears the room. But this was a different kind of rage. And it came from my childhood and not feeling like I could speak my truth. So I had all of this around my mouth. I got in touch with kind of the emotional, physical, spiritual connection that was going on. And the amount of forgiveness work that I needed to do. And by Christmas Day and about 3 hours with Edith and continuing on with my own personal process, the paralysis was gone completely. The learning is that there are still times that every once in a while I'll look in the mirror and my eye will start to droop. It's my signal that there's something there that I'm not paying attention to, and there's some forgiveness that needs to be done. So, and a lot of that has to do with learning to love myself. I'm very good at sharing my talents and gifts with other people, but I don't always fill myself ahead of time. So I'm learning lots about that. There is one of the places I love to travel is Hawaii. And I've been gifted with the ability to go there a number of times. And my parents have a timeshare there. And the Hawaiians have a forgiveness process that I absolutely love, and it's called Ho'oponopono. And it's a reconciliation and forgiveness practice. And I think it makes perfect sense. That's why I'm going to share it. And then it's been changed over the years, but at my parents' condo, which is very, very un-Hawaiian. It's made to look commercial. It's commercial, but and made to look Hawaiian, but it's certainly not of the Hawaiian culture by any means. It's a little path down to a part of a beach that is, there's a little label that says this is the little space that we've left for the Hawaiians here at this condominium complex. And I thought, well, that's kind of fit with my little perspective about how we do things to other cultures. But what I noticed that every single day at sunset, I would notice 2, 3, 4, 10 sometimes Hawaiians coming with their children, sometimes by themselves, coming as close to the ocean that they can through this little tiny path. And I watched them, and it was a very reverent experience for me. I had no idea what was going on until I learned about it later. And basically, they believe that you never let the sun set when you have any negative feelings for yourself, your brother, your neighbor, whoever. So there, it's a releasing process that they do every single day when the sun sets. And there are people who have studied with the Hawaiians, theirs is a four-step process, and it says, I love you, I am sorry, or I will do it differently next time. I forgive you, and thank you. Now, if you were to say those four words the same way, with meaning, each, and kind of review your day, I think it would be amazing. There is another forgiveness process that I've come across by a gentleman named Robert Eller Isaacs. And for me, it speaks to how I want to live in the world, and I often use it with the idea of Ho'oponopono at the end of the day, particularly when I've had a tough day and I know I've got some baggage that I want to unload before I go to bed. So I'm going to read you a line, and then the response is the same. Feel free to join in. So for remaining silent when a single voice would have made a difference. And the response is, I forgive myself, I forgive you, and we begin again in love. So let's all say that out loud. I forgive myself, I forgive you, we begin again in love. Okay, so for remaining silent when a single voice would have made a difference, I forgive myself, I forgive you, we begin again in love. For each time that our fears have made us rigid and inaccessible, I forgive myself, I forgive you, we begin again in love. For each time that we have struck out in anger without just cause, I forgive myself, I forgive you, we begin again in love. For each time that our greed has blinded us to the needs of others, I forgive myself, I forgive you, we begin again in love. For the selfishness which sets us apart and alone, I forgive myself, I forgive you, we begin again in love. For falling short of the admonitions of the Spirit, I forgive myself, I forgive you, we begin again in love. For losing sight of our unity, I forgive myself, I forgive you, we begin again. For those and for so many acts, both evident and subtle, which have fueled my illusion of separateness, I forgive myself, I forgive you, we begin again in love. So, looks like I ought to have the lively, funny story next. This, I hope, is the last time I have to tell this. There's a wonderful cultural anthropologist named Angeles Arian, and she studied indigenous tribes all over the world and has written a wonderful book called The Fourfold Way. And I'm curious about other cultures and their practices, and I'm very clear to make sure the door I walk through is the door with Jesus holding my hand, but I also think that there's a lot that other cultures have to offer us. And she talks about a tribal community. And as she studied the various tribal communities, she's come up with similarities in them. But this is one of my favorite things from her book. And she says, in many tribes, you as a community member get to speak your story into the circle where there's listening, deep listening usually, without any interruption, three times. That's it. And I think to the many times I've told the same story to the same people sometimes, I think some CFO speakers I've heard and JFO speakers I've heard, it's like, oh God, here we go again. But what if we have to invent new stories about who we are and who our lives are currently in this present moment and our walk with Jesus? So she also says, after three times, the community takes one look at you and says, want to keep telling that story? Your work is with the medicine man. We take it out of the circle, you go deal with it. And many tribes actually don't allow you to tell the story until you have the essence, until you have the learning and the teaching to share the story. But they will allow what they consider community stories to continue to be told, to continue the story of who they are and their cosmology. So this, I think, is my last time to tell this story, although I think it's been more than three times, but it's another humbling experience. So I'm at this hospital in Placerville. I've moved up the as far as I can move. I've been hired by, well, no, I haven't. I'm a nurse. I have a lot of ideas. The nursing administrator has just been fired. I've been hired. I told you what that was like. And I'm still very uncomfortable about being so young because I don't look like anybody else. And there are people, I actually had people submit my name to the California Department of Health because I was too young to be competent. They filed a claim and they had to come investigate. And I was like, oh my God. So my remedy for that at 26 was I went to a power dressing class. Okay? So now imagine this, the power colors, the navy blue suit. That's, I'm gonna date myself here, but that's when tying scarves for women executives was a big deal. And you know, the right color scarf, and I wore higher heels then because it made me feel taller and I'm short anyway. Whatever that was about, it was all ego. But I had been the director of nursing for about 6 months, and I was hired by the CEO, who obviously saw something in me. I'm still not sure what. He was only about 10 years older than I was, so we're both fairly young for those positions. And actually the best boss I ever worked for him for 10 years. But I wanted to make all the changes I'd voiced, and he allowed me to do that. The nurses, of course, loved it. Well, guess what? The surgeons did not. And as a nurse sometimes, now keep in mind, I have difficulty with surgeons because it's hard to get them to work together. But when I'm bleeding to death and on an operating room table, I'm real glad they have huge egos and are not afraid to make decisions. So there's a place for that. But I was always in meetings with these folks trying to get them to agree. So several of them that had a lot of power in the hospital were not happy. And several of the nurses who were kind of set in their ways were also not happy. So I had been called to the surgery review committee, which met at 7 a.m. And the reason it met at 7 was because surgery started at 8, and if you were late, you put patients off all day because they had to finish their meeting. So it's very important to be there on time. And I'd gotten wind that they wanted to fire me, basically. They couldn't, but they were going to make it so miserable for me, they were going to fire me. And so I was extremely nervous. They're surgeons. I'm smart enough to know that I needed to come up with a logical argument for every new thing I was trying to implement. And I was young, so I was trying to do it all at once. Now, the interesting part of that is it worked. I didn't know enough to not know any better. Could have probably been a little kinder and gentler along the way. So I had worked out all of these arguments. I basically obsessed about it. I got up that morning to get my daughter to the babysitter so that I could get to this meeting by 7 o'clock, and she woke up with an earache. And what that meant was babysitter B instead of babysitter A, which took another 20 minutes because babysitter B could get her to the pediatrician to check her ear out. And so I was racing around the house. I whipped on my clothes. It was snowing outside. Tried to drive slowly in the snow, got her to babysitter B, and I arrived about 25 minutes late for this meeting. And they were, not only did they want to fire me, but they were horribly insulted. And I knew I had just added fuel to the fire. So I walked in, and I whipped off my coat, and they all went. And I'd actually forgotten to put my skirt on. And I had one of those, now I had the perfect jacket on with the perfect tie of the scarf, no skirt. And I was nervous. And I looked down, and luckily I had a slip on, but it was one of those slips that had been through the dryer a million times. It was an ugly slip. It wasn't beautiful lingerie. And so I didn't know what to do. They didn't know what to do. And so I immediately whipped my coat back on. And now I noticed you were a little sleepy about forgiveness, but you're all awake now. I whipped my coat back on, and I left the room. I was so embarrassed. You just want a hole to open up, swallow you, never see those people again. So I walked out, and my house was 25 minutes away, and I couldn't go back and change clothes. So I walked into surgery and put on surgical scrubs, which are the same thing that they were wearing. And I knew I had to walk back in that room, but I did not want to do it. In fact, as I was walking out and the door was closing, I heard the loudest roar of laughter I had ever heard. And I was like, so I bravely got my courage up and walked back in the room, and they started with their questions. You could tell they'd organized it. They'd organized who was going to ask what. And this was the big gang up, let's gang up on Diane thing. And they'd say, well, we want to know why you're doing such and such. And I'd start to answer. And one of the other surgeons, they were all men at the time, would say, well, you know, I think we would give a reason. And I thought, well, it's a good reason. I'll just let go. And then somebody else would ask just kind of a scathing question and very accusatory. And I'd start to answer, and somebody else in the room would answer. And this went on for about 20 minutes. And I didn't say a word. They were talking to each other. And finally, the chief of surgery said, well, you know, we're just not really happy with any of this, but we're going to give you another 6 months. And I thought, well, first of all, you don't get to decide whether I stay or go. But I had not said one word. Now, I did not laugh about that till probably 5 years later. I was such a serious person in my 20s. But to this day, I know that was God working, and that was probably the only reason I kept my job and was allowed to implement what I did. Now, it's an embarrassing thing to have happen, but it was one of those things. Now, unfortunately, this has been about 30 years now. So 30 years ago, I occasionally, when I left the hospital, I left on great terms. It was time for me to do something new. And I would get invited back to Christmas parties or over to a physician's house or whatever. And people would, there was always one of these guys there. And they'd always say, remember that time you showed up at a meeting without the skirt? So over those 30 years, I got continually reminded of that very humbling moment. The good news is many of them are dead now. I don't get as reminded as much, but the legacy that continues. So that is the last time I'll tell that story. That's one of the ones that said, oh, you're going to tell them about the time you forgot to wear your skirt? So, in terms of my new experiences, I'm going to be sharing something that's very fresh for me. And I had really hoped to have the learning consolidated so that I could share with you the experience and the learning. But what I understand now and the way God is working this is that I have to share from a place of not knowing. And I think I'm hesitant to share that, so I'm probably sure I should share it. And I would ask your listening and your prayers for me coming to a place of knowing when the time is right. And remember, I'd gotten in guidance, no judgments, no expectations, and don't worry about what happens tomorrow. So I think I've been very patient. I've been living that way for about 2 years, and the last 8 months have been even more of a stretch for me. I'm at a threshold of some kind with God, and I'm not sure what that is. And I get there, I know that I'm there, I know there's new learning, it's just out of my reach. Sometimes I'll have dreams, sometimes I'll get some guidance in meditation, but it's just, I can't quite put it all together. But there's a knowing that there's a next step. Now, I think I've taken plenty of steps in my life, and there's this little two-year-old that wants to have a tantrum about that. That's also why I know that they're probably on the right track here. But in 2008, I made some difficult choices, and the person that was in charge of my retirement fund that I was not paying a lot of attention to made some choices that, frankly, I wasn't even paying any attention to. But like many people, most of what I had socked away, which wasn't much for my retirement, was gone. And I said, okay, God, how are we going to do this one? I trust you. I have faith in you. And I sat there 1 month, literally not knowing how I was going to pay the phone bill. You know, keep in mind, I make good money. I've always made good money. I've never even worried about earning my way. And all I knew to do was pray. I didn't need to tell my story to a lot of people, although there was a little bit of drama, family drama I could have shared. And it was just, I knew I needed to pray. And two things happened. One is I had people send me money that I had not talked to, did not know what was going on. I even had a former client who was so happy with what I'd done with them for a couple years ago, send me like a bonus check. So I got these things through the mail that I was, not the ways I was thinking of working at McDonald's. I was willing to do whatever God wanted me to do. I just didn't understand it. And it came very clearly to me that I probably couldn't support the condo that I was living in. When I had consulting jobs, I would, they would pay all my expenses, but the cash flow was really tight, and the little nest egg that I'd put away had evaporated. So I was praising God, thanking God, doing everything I could think of, and another week went by, and a friend called from Washington, up in Port Angeles, Washington. And I had been with her probably 10 years ago. She'd been in a women's circle of mine, had a very nice experience, and we had kept in touch. And she actually had a home in a cabin on the lake in Lake Tahoe that she owned, but had not been living in for about 10 years because she was in Port Angeles, Washington. And she'd just been down to visit her cabin, and it needed some maintenance because they only showed up about twice a year. And she called and she said, you know, I really want someone to caretake our cabin, and I would love for that to be you. And again, thank you, God. So we talked about it. They would only come down for 8 days a year, 4 days at Christmas and 4 days over the 4th of July. And in the meantime, I would have this wonderful place to live right on the lake. It was kind of an old funky cabin, but it was fine with me. We had to get the critters out and all those things. And so they were retiring in 5 years, and we had a 5-year plan, and I would be there for 5 years. I'd be able to put some things away that I wouldn't, because I wouldn't have a living expenses. I was going to pay utilities, and that was it. And that was an answer to prayer. It truly was, and I'm very grateful for that. In September of last year, I got a phone call from her, and her husband, who's a veterinarian, has pancreatic cancer. So the 5-year plan turned into a 2-year plan, and they moved back to Tahoe within 2 weeks. And my 5-year plan also turned into a very quick 2-year plan. And so essentially I had to find a place to live, and winter was coming. I had the autumn camp that I was a chairperson, maybe I was a speaker, I don't know. I had some leadership role in the autumn camp, so that was a week. So I really only had a week. And I had to find a place to live, and I had this feeling I only needed to find a place for the winter. So I launched an email out to everybody I knew and said, it's hard for me to ask for help, but that's what I was told to do, so I did. And it said, Diane needs a home. And that was exactly it. That's what I needed. And I had 5 choices. And they were amazing. I thought, well, Diane needs a home, and I didn't want to put in parentheses, it doesn't cost a lot of money. So I went to investigate my choices. Now, I live at Lake Tahoe. I love living at Lake Tahoe. It snows, but I don't like shoveling snow a whole lot. That's another story later on. And I drove over to a friend's father's house who had just died of Alzheimer's. And it was a cabin on the mountaintop, literally 8,000 feet, overlooking Donner Lake, for those of you that are familiar with California. Truckee's the closest town in. It was beautiful, but I drove up and up and up and up and up this road, and I thought, there's no way. I live by myself. I don't like to shovel snow. I'm willing to do it, but they get a lot more snow on the top of that mountain than they would. So I already had my thank you, I appreciate it, but story figured out. They did have a garage and covered wood storage, which in snow country is the biggest blessing you can get. I've never had that, by the way. But and I walked into the house, and it was filthy. It was loaded with junk. There were cobwebs that had been there for 8 years. He hadn't lived there for 8 years, that were like baskets of cobwebs. And I knew that's where I needed to spend the winter. But everything in my logical mind was like going, are you kidding? This is crazy. You cannot do this. So I looked at my other choices, but this is where I feel things. This is where my intuition said, my logic said, do not pass go, do not go back here, do not do anything. And so I prayed about it, and I made a phone call the next day and said, when can I move in? So we hauled 4 dumpsters of stuff out of there. Was able to give a lot to a hospice thrift store in town, move just a few of my things in there because I was only going to be there for the winter, and started kind of a mountaintop experience, and that's exactly what it felt like. And I thought, great, whatever this is out there that I can't quite get a hold of, I'll be able to figure it out on the top of this mountain. And I figured out a way to survive, so I didn't have to go out unless I had to get to the airport and then I had and fly out somewhere. So what happened was a client that usually keeps me very busy most of the winter had huge budget cuts. I teach some basic management classes for the Forest Service, and I get these new 20-something young people in for a week to talk about things like communication, conflict resolution, performance evaluations. And although I really don't necessarily like the way the federal government approaches things, I do love people who love the land. And these are young, excited, passionate folks just out of school, very usually very well educated. And so I did what I could. I loved the folks in front of me, but I made very good money doing this. And then last year they cut the budget. They cut education out of the Forest Service. So here I was. Not only was I'm on the mountaintop, but the income wasn't coming in. So to shorten the story a little bit, where I am right now is I know I'm not to be there another winter. I survived, I'm here to tell you. 100-mile-an-hour winds, it's on a ridge. I never saw it snow, which I love to watch it snow in Lake Tahoe. Everything was horizontal. The icicles went like this. I have some pictures I can show you. And the winter before that, there was 16 feet of snow on each side of the driveway. So I was talking to a neighbor before I moved in, and I said, you know, the only thing I'm really worried about is there's a big deck about the size of this that overlooks this lovely lake, this Sierra Mountains. It's just beautiful, part of the Pacific Crest Trail. And the neighbor said, oh, you don't have to worry about snow on your deck. I thought, I'm not sure I want to shovel that much, 16 feet of that. I don't want to shovel, nor do I want to keep it up. He said, oh, you don't have to worry about that at all. It blows off your deck in between your house and the next house and into my driveway across the street. I shovel your snow. So I thought, So I didn't know whether to believe him or not, but I thought, well, I'll trust that. And sure enough, about the most snow I had on that deck was about 4 inches because of the gale force winds. So we also had the lightest snow in 30 years that winter. Now, I'm not saying I messed with the weather. I don't do that. And I'm not saying that that was an answer to prayer because I didn't do that prayer. But my prayer was to do whatever I needed to do, to learn whatever I needed to learn, to take my next steps, and let go of what I think. And that's not always easy for me. So I'm still in the midst of this. I'm moving back to Lake Tahoe. I took quite a chunk out of my income by them cutting these education classes, and I realized I wound up in a different place, but a similar place to where I was about 20 years ago, before my divorce, where I was living two lives. And although I've made a lot of changes since then, it's a somewhat familiar pattern, different circumstances. But what that required was that I step out of something that wasn't true for me and move into what I needed to do next. And I did that with great reluctance. So here I am again. And although I enjoy teaching the Forest Service classes, my real love is the healing design work that I do, and the healing work that I do, and the women's circles that I do. And so I have a feeling God's pointing me in that direction. And what the deal that I did in 2008 was with these Forest Service classes, I would make large sums of money, work maybe 6-8 weeks out of the year, and then I would be able to pick the clients I wanted, do the work I wanted, sometimes do the work for free if it was needed, and do what I really felt God wanted me to do. And I still felt really good about the work I was doing with the Forest Service. So Forest Service evaporates, and here I am, still wanting to do the work I really love to do, but not knowing how to ask for the money to support myself. So part of that is my own internal struggle, so I would ask for your prayers. Part of it is following my guidance, and that is to live in this. I have another wonderful little cabin on the lake, on the west shore of the lake this time. And with much less snow, no garage, unfortunately, but can't have everything. And I only have probably another 6-8 months through the probably through till June before I hope to find a permanent home. And the possibilities are endless. Every time I move, my earthly possessions get smaller and smaller. I made a joke about 2 years ago when I said, well, geez, one of these days I'll be able to carry everything around in the backpack. My fear is that actually might come true. And I guess I need to be okay with that. So part of it is, I guess I would ask for your prayers. I don't like to ask for prayers to put labels on what I need because I don't think I know what I need. But I would like you to lift me and pray for me, and I will, I'm not sure I'll know the conclusion by the end of camp. But again, it has to do with not knowing, staying in that place of not knowing, and waiting for the right action to emerge. And I don't have a lot of patience, and I really don't hope I have to learn a lot about patience. So, let's see. I'd like to end with a story about my first CFO camp. I told you a little bit about that. I'm going to use the song. So, after having this incredible week that I couldn't even describe to people, I was really glad for the, what do they call that, the talk that they give you before you go home. Yeah, there you go. And I was really glad for that because I was on fire. I was so excited about this. Everybody I knew was coming next year. It was an experience beyond words. And my prayer at that first CFO camp, which I'm sure is very connected to this process I'm going through now, was that God help me figure out a way to bring this pattern, this rhythm, this experience into the business world, into healthcare. And I launched that prayer and didn't think anything about it until about 3 months later, and I'm driving home with a friend in the car. We're in Sacramento. I don't even remember where we were, but I said, you've got to stop the car. And I can remember going to the closest restaurant. I think it was an IHOP or a Denny's or something with plastic food, but it didn't matter because I wanted that placemat so I could write down what was happening. She had no paper in the car. I had no paper with me except, you know, the little check stub, the back of a check, and I was like, that wasn't going to work. And what came was something very different than I expected, but I think was the answer to that prayer and has been unfolding ever since. And what I believe I experienced at that first CFO camp and that I feel is such a deep taproot here at this camp is something that one of a favorite writer of mine, an Irish Catholic priest named John O'Donohue, calls the architecture of belonging. That there's a pattern and a rhythm to thing to God, to Jesus, and that in fact that architecture has something to do with us knowing we're home. And I wanted to bring that into healing environments, into healthcare, and you know, over the last 20 years or so, that 25 years, that's unfolded in amazing ways, and I'll share some of those stories tomorrow. But what came instead of these are, you know, go down to the end of the street, turn right, do these three things, was actually a series of movements, very much like a rhythms. And I'd like to share that with you, and I'd like you to join me. So I'd like to ask you to stand, and I'm going to go over the movements with you. Let's see, I'm just going to stand over here and have you listen to me without the microphone. So, and what has unfolded over the last 25 years is a process with which I work with all my clients and myself. So, nothing like it went out. And then I released it because it was never.